starting to understand Black women, you know, and how that comes down to listening and really hearing what their experiences are saying about the world and their existence. One of the things that's, I think, useful is that there's a 10-point, you know, how to make someone feel understood list. And they seem quite easy. I'm just going to list them off for us. Number one is expect it to take time and energy. We can't decide whether someone's worth getting to know based on one little thing. And so, you know, dropping the assumptions, which is number two, allows for us to, you know, step in and actually be fully present, which is number three. Number four is use the power of perspective and allow ourselves to see things in a unique or different way. And I guess, you know, when we allow that neuroplasticity to engage and be a little bit more flexible in our mind, then yeah, a whole world can open up. And that really is the power of perspective. You know, there's options and possibilities that we might not have seen right in front of us before. Number five on the list is read the body language. The percentage is that 80% of our body language is telling us more than the 20% of our spoken word language about what it is that we're saying. And so, you know, when we're paying attention to more than just the words, and, you know, whether someone has their arms crossed or whether someone is really back in their chair or, you know, coming forward with interest, that shows and it matters. And we can read those as very clear signs. Number six is listening fully instead of halfway. This term, half listening, is something that is sort of new to me in a way, but it's a bad modern habit that we are checking our phones or going over our shopping list or thinking about the next place we need to be or how we might have forgot to lock the door, or, you know, the list is endless. And so being a better listener is about being present and really focused on full listening rather than having half of your brain in one place and half of your brain in another. We can practice reflecting back and, you know, paraphrasing or rephrasing and repeating what someone had said to you so that there's a clarity about being on the same page and that you're really expressing understanding in the way that you're hearing someone say what they've expressed. Another way is to ask really good questions. And this is all about open-ended questions rather than, you know, having just yes-no answers. I was watching a YouTube video about someone who'd been trained by the CIA or something, and they were demonstrating how you could get someone to fall in love with you almost immediately by asking questions that revealed things about the person who was being asked the questions, because they're by getting answers that are a little bit more lengthy, then we have places to build commonalities and base experience on, or ask more questions for clarification. And so that real interpersonal relationship gets built through these deeper questions and that ability to ask not yes, no questions. Number nine, watch out for projection. Projection is something that's a psychological sort of phenomenon when we unconsciously attribute the way we ourselves are thinking and feeling to others and avoid facing up to our own unwanted emotions or thoughts. And so, you know, that can, for example, look like if you don't like someone but feel guilty about it, you might instead tell everybody that the other person doesn't like you. And so it kind of gets you off the hook a little bit. And it allows, when you stop doing that, it allows for you to see others for what they are and not for what you need them to handle for you. And, you know, we hear that sort of a lot in the decolonization conversation where, you know, people shouldn't have to educate us about their position or, you know, their history or those kinds of things, which doesn't eliminate the possibility for asking open-ended questions, but you know, we don't have a right to put our garbage onto other people because we're not ready to deal with it. And number 10 is learning to understand ourselves better and learning the ways in which we think and feel make it easier to have compassion for other people and being in that, you know, take a moment to step into someone else's shoes kind of idea. Not that that's always possible, for sure, but sometimes the power of imagination can do us a lot of good. So enough of that. I'm going to play a song here. VIFF, that's the Vancouver International Film Festival, they have a lot, or have had a lot going on actually all month in terms of films for Black History Month. And they're playing a film called Bam Bam, The Sister Nancy Story. And I was really kind of surprised, I guess, to learn that dance hall queen, Sister Nancy, is the feature of this documentary. but that her signature tune, Bam Bam, enjoys the status of the most sampled reggae song of them all. Of them all. And so we're gonna hear that. You're gonna recognize it, and that's okay. Here it is. Enjoy Sister Nancy and Bam Bam. And look it up, because it's playing at the Vancouver International Film Festival Friday, Saturday, and Monday.
Think of a bomb, bomb. The little whistle arms on me, a can. Little different style, different fashion. You know? Tell me, say one thing, Nancy, if you understand. One thing, Nancy, if you understand. One thing, they might talk about me, ambition. Say one thing, they might talk about me, ambition. Come and say some of them ask me where me get it from. Tell some of them ask me where me get it from. I told them, no, no, it's from creation. I told them, no, no, it's from creation. Bam, bam.
Correct. Correct. Correct.
Bibio Sound Machine with Political Incorrect here on Intravenous. Welcome back. The next thing I've got up for you is a little tidbit of a conversation that happened through SFU Public Square. A couple of years back, they held a keynote address with renowned scholar and activists Angela Davis and Gina Dent, who were here to reflect on their then recently released book, Abolition Feminism. And so we're just going to listen to a few minutes of that talk, partly because it's very, very long, and we don't have time even to listen to the whole thing if we took the hour. But I sort of grabbed these 6 to 7 minutes out because I really felt like they had kind of a potent message for us in terms of what we're looking at with the idea of dreaming in a new reality and, you know, in keeping with listening to Black women talking about futures and lifting up a new generation. So here, without ado, is Angela Davis and Gina Dent talking.
Yes, I guess I should say that in that way we're inspired by Audre Lorde. I assume all of you know who we're speaking about. You know, we talk a lot, so we're both censoring ourselves because we know we could go on and on. There's a lot we want to say, but I think I want to backtrack a little bit and say a little bit more about why this book, what we're trying to do. We absolutely had been at the margins of so many conversations. And it was natural to think that once we were going to center our own voices, that we would be able to proceed. But of course, what I think all minoritized people come to understand is that when you're then given an opportunity to quote unquote be at the center, it's actually not so easy because nothing at the center is arranged in terms of how you are going to proceed. And so we went very much, as Angela explained, through a process which we see as indicative of the power of abolition feminism. So I think now I should just say a little bit about what we mean by this. Probably this audience is a little self-selected and knows a lot about what this means, but the abolition side of it, I think, is fairly obvious to people in certain ways, and they think about not only the need to reform prisons. I really appreciated Dr. Johnson talking about the statistics in this region, but what we know as people who have been working in the tradition of prison activism and scholarship for a very long time is that the working at the specific problems to try to remediate, for example, the statistical majority of whatever, or to try to reduce a certain population, doesn't address the critical problem that incarceration is in our societies. So abolitionists are seeking to live out, not in the future, but in the now, the experience of being free and to share that with others, whether they are inside or outside. And so that means being in everyday situations that we're in and rejecting the carcerality that is presented to us as safety. And of course, when it comes to the question of feminism, that is often very difficult to do. And so Angela was alluding to the feminist frameworks that are sometimes labeled now carceral feminism, where we're invited to be a part of what is characterized as modern democratic culture, and I'm putting that in scare quotes, people who are going to invest in the same state structures that settler colonialism has given us. And so we do something as abolition feminists, which is essentially like living in multiple times. We are pragmatic enough to know that certain reforms are absolutely necessary. When people say they're being mistreated inside, when there are harms being created, then we want to address those harms. But we simultaneously want to live in the future or in the time of abolition. And that means also thinking about what the choices we make in the now might do if we're invested in a different way of being together in the future. So we could talk a lot about all the different problems that we face. And of course, gender violence is often at the heart of the issues that tend to fortify our systems of incarceration and our criminal legal systems. And so we felt we needed a book that would speak to do a number of different things. One, and I think this is where we're probably less successful, is to decenter certain narratives that have to do with only Black people and mass incarceration and the U.S. So, you know, it's not often really known, for example, that the group of people that have the highest incarceration rates in the United States are actually indigenous people, too. We talk a lot about Black incarceration. Obviously, that's a very serious issue, but it's often the way the prison system organizes knowledge that lets us only attend to certain questions. And so in some of our book, we're trying to break with the traditions of telling certain things about a history of incarceration. And we're also trying to lift up the feminist strategies that have been at the heart of anti-prison movements, but that are constantly disappeared from the histories of those movements. Now, that's not only a problem of attribution, in other words, who's responsible, who's out there, but it's also a problem for what abolition will end up being. And so, for us, the feminism is inextricably linked to the modalities of abolition that we think are going to be making for a better future and addressing all of the issues, we use the term now, intersectionally or holistically, that are connected to these forms of harm.
I think it would be important to point out that modes of conceptualization and modes of practice that Gina refers to, which we often name intersectional. I'm still very ambivalent about the term intersectionality, not because I don't think it does important work. It absolutely does. But it has become so much of a catchword that people aren't motivated to try to understand what that really means. And for me, that is the very core of feminism. not only thinking gender, when gender has often been erased, gender, sexuality, but also thinking together issues and concepts and categories that have so often been thought about separately. So of course, when we refer to feminism, we are referring to a feminism or feminisms that are anti-racist and also anti-capitalist, anti-colonial, and oftentimes the category feminism is so charged that it is assumed only to refer to women, right? And we like to think of feminism as a methodology. As a methodology, not only of research and thinking, but a methodology of practice. As Gina pointed out, we tried, I don't even know whether we succeeded, but I think every time we had a conversation in the course of writing this book, we made the point that we could not fail to, you know, challenge the United States centrism of this work, that we had to take into consideration what's happening here in Canada. And in so many respects, activists and scholars are far ahead of what we've been able to accomplish in the US, in so many respects not. Brazil, if you want to think about the impact of carcerality on a society, look at Brazil. Look at the police violence. We also wanted to not assume that the anti-racist dimension of abolitionist work is no longer functional in places like South Africa, where the assumption is the worst representation of racism has been laid to rest. So we refer to the fact that there are movements in South Africa against racist police violence, precisely because of the fact that the structures of racism still determine the nature of policing, despite the fact that virtually all of the policing agents are now black, are now African.
Just a little snippet there from SFU's keynote with Angela Davis and Gina Dent.